This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
More protests for racial equality are planned for the weekend. We speak with activists in Minneapolis and London who say this time feels different, bigger, more global.
Something that gets lost very easily is the globalness of blackness, right?
Absolutely. This is a moment of reckoning.
Also, a story of racial prejudice within the family. A comedian born to an Iranian dad and an African-American mom shares his story.
I remember specifically a cousin of mine on my black side asking me to tell him when the next 9/11 was going to happen.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, with the pandemic and lockdowns, we all still need a vacation. Some countries are forming partnerships so travelers can start using their passports again.
Free travel zones go by a couple names: Corona corridors, travel bubbles.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World on a Friday. It's good to be with you. Worldwide demonstrations against police violence continue. More major protests planned for this weekend. We'll be speaking later with activist organizers here and in London. First, though, another kind of protest. In several French cities, police officers stood in a line and threw down their handcuffs one by one. They were protesting a new French ban on chokeholds and neck restraints. The police union argues that these techniques can be a necessary part of the handcuffing process and that there is no other proven technique to subdue someone who refuses to comply with police demands. The history of police violence looks very different across the globe, but there is often one common denominator. Aggressive policing disproportionately impacts young black men. As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the protests that have followed have revived the policing debate in Latin America, in places like Brazil and Colombia.
One week before George Floyd was killed, a young man was assaulted by two police officers outside of his home in southwestern Colombia. His name was Anderson Arboleda. He was 19. Anderson made a living selling shoes and, during the pandemic, face masks, says his mother, Claudia Jimena Arboleda. The night he was beaten, she says police officers chased Anderson home because he had violated the pandemic curfew. The officers beat him with batons and he died in the hospital the following morning. But Arboleda says she prefers to remember the way he lived. Anderson recorded himself singing along with friends, showing off his smile, his braces, and his six-pack abs. His favorite things were to be on his phone, eat, and walk around without a shirt on, his mother says. Anderson was like a lot of teenagers, and he died like far too many black teenagers die in Colombia, says Ali Bantu Ashanti, a human rights attorney in Bogota.
Lo que le pasó a Anderson es algo que le ha ocurrido, le pasa a diario a la población afrocolombiana, especialmente.
Bantu Ashanti says what happened to Anderson is something that happens every day to Afro-Colombians. Systemic racism has a wide reach.
Revisas, digamos, las cifras de pobreza, si tú revisas las cifras en los homicidios de los.
If you look at homicides, poverty, education, and health access, you begin to understand the marginalization of Afro-Colombians, Bantu Ashanti says. But it wasn't until after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis that the death of Anderson Arboleda in Colombia became mainstream news.
Para nosotros fue un poco un tanto extraño cómo esto empezó a viralizarse en redes sociales, sobre todo en.
It was strange to see how the George Floyd story went viral and then the story of Anderson Arboleda, Bantu Ashanti says. But the issue of race is different in every country. Jerome Branch studies Afro-Latino literature at the University of Pittsburgh. He points out that countries south of the border never legalized discrimination the way the United States did.
That kind of overt legal separation did not occur in the modern Latin American republics. What you have instead in their case was ideas that tended to downplay discrimination and segregation.
For example, in another South American country, Brazilians have a long held belief that people of all races have the same opportunities. They call it racial democracy, which to Paula Barreto, sociologist at Federal University in Bahia, is not true now, and it never was.
Because yes, we have color line. We have racial segregation. We have racial inequalities. We have more black people concentrated among the poor neighborhoods where the police is used to kill people.
In Rio de Janeiro alone, the police killed 1,800 people last year. 80% of them were Afro-Brazilian, according to government figures. And the recent protests in the U.S. have helped bring attention to the issue in the mainstream Brazilian press. There have been protests, and Barreto says many white Brazilians are beginning to see parallels they didn't see before.
You know, the American opinion and the international opinion about Brazil, it's important for Brazilians in general. So Brazilians don't want to see themselves as racist, and they don't want to see their country associated with homicides of the black population.
Barreto says she hopes the momentum will carry beyond this cathartic moment. She says she hopes it'll inspire the country to do more for the civil rights of Afro-Brazilians. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
The other big story that we're following, the coronavirus pandemic. The number of daily cases continues to grow. About 150,000 people are now being diagnosed daily worldwide. As for the global economy, forecasts remain gloomy. Some sectors are all but destroyed. Tourism, to name one. The UN World Tourism Organization estimates that international travel could decline by 80% this year. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, nations and their travel industries are not throwing in the towel.
Governments around the world are trying to revitalize their tourism economies, and they're starting close to home, says Per Bloch, an Oxford University researcher in social mobility.
The idea to start reallowing travel is not to open all borders to everybody, but that countries form free travel zones.
Free travel zones go by a couple names: Corona corridors, travel bubbles. They're agreements with neighboring regions that allow for travel across borders for non-essential trips without quarantining upon arrival. Countries don't need to have zero cases of COVID-19 to form a travel bubble, but all countries involved should be at a similar stage of reopening.
That's what's happening in many European countries. Travelers slowly being allowed again, even though the caseload is nowhere near zero.
The European Commission recently released a report recommending this buddy-up strategy for EU member states. Spain, Italy, Greece, and Portugal have signed on, agreeing to welcome travelers from the EU. Norway and Denmark opened their borders to just each other, leaving other Scandinavian countries out of immediate plans. And beyond Europe, people from Singapore and select Chinese provinces can now travel for business without having to quarantine for 14 days. Further south,
today there are no active cases in New Zealand.
New Zealand reported zero active coronavirus cases this week, reviving the idea of a travel bubble with Australia. But New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says, not yet.
We need to be assured that when we open up to Australia, we can do that with confidence. There are still cases in Australia, so we do need to be careful. They're not quite in the position New Zealand is in.
Prime Minister Ardern is cautious. So is the EU. Though European Commission spokesperson Sonia Gospodinova says a plan to loosen the travel restrictions is being built.
We are looking ahead to resuming the travel from outside the European Union very shortly, possibly in July.
It's unlikely travel will resume with the United States, though, because like the kind made of soap and water, travel bubbles are fragile. Lives are at stake. The U.S. has one of the worst infection rates in the world, and the lack of widespread testing and contact tracing might doom its chances of being invited into any travel bubble at this point, even with its closest neighbors.
Canada and the United States have once again agreed to extend by 30 days the current measures in place along the border.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the U.S.-Canada border will be closed through June at the least. Amir Adaran, a professor of law and epidemiology at the University of Ottawa, agrees with the decision.
I think it's simply inarguable that we in Canada stand to gain very little by opening the border to the United States. I don't particularly think that Canada is a success to which the United States should compare itself. We have failed too. We just have not failed as badly as you have.
Those in favor of reopening the border point to Canada's reliance on the U.S. for tourism. According to the Tourism Industry Association of Canada, nearly 70% of people visiting Canada come from the U.S. But Adaran says the marketplace can't operate without a healthy population.
Americans need to get quite realistic about this. Unless you get this disease under control quickly, it is not just the end of your economy. It's the end of your country, really.
America has already begun opening for U.S. tourists, though. If you're in the States and looking for vacation plans, a road trip may be your best bet. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Travel to tourist spots in West Africa's Sahel region plummeted several years ago with the arrival of extremist militants, offshoots of Al-Qaeda. Today, for the people living on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert, violence has become a part of everyday life. In Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, fighting between government forces and armed militia groups has led to mass migration. We're going to focus on landlocked Burkina Faso, where armed groups are now attacking civilians, as well as schools and health facilities. People are fleeing villages for their lives. David Beasley is the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program.
It's a very bad situation. You can imagine, with all the extremist group activity in the last few years, a complete deterioration economically in the fragile state, coupled with droughts and flash flooding. And just in the last year alone, we've seen what was 688,000 people this same time last year were in need of food assistance, and now it's 2.15 million.
So are militants in Burkina Faso using food as a weapon? What reports have you seen where that is the case?
Yes, to the degree they can get food, they use food as a weapon of recruitment. And if they can control the food and medicines, then they recruit using the food that they control.
So, David, you're the head of the World Food Program. How does the WFP actually get food to people to three countries?
Well, it's a lot of negotiating. And the good news is we've got the expertise and the experience of how to do this. Every time we face famine in countries, you know, if we can get the money, get the access, we get it done.
So we've read about attacks by militants, by outlaw groups, David, but we also hear that government forces and military units from France and the U.S. may be making the situation worse, civilians caught in the crossfire. Is that something aid workers see as complicating your own work?
Well, one of the things, you know, it's an interesting, as you mentioned, it's not so simple. To create food security, you got to have security. We negotiate with all sides to get the access we need. And because the warring factions understand what we're doing, we're neutral. We just want to keep innocent victims of conflict alive so they can survive and hopefully have a better day.
But if activists in Mali and Burkina Faso are saying French and U.S. troops are actually making the problems worse, I mean, how do you at the U.N. square that circle if you're trying to feed people?
Well, as I said, we do our best to make certain they understand the problems that we're facing when there's conflict and aggression, regardless of which side it may be on, right, wrong, good, or bad. And the key is the communication. And we've got to be where they go, otherwise they won't have food. And so they'll starve to death, or you'll have famine, a combination of dynamics. And now with COVID, it is really creating extreme issues, as you can imagine, with landlocked areas and all the issues that we're talking about, the movement of people in this time of year.
Right. I mean, well, as you said, this is the lean time. It's the end of granary stocks in West Africa. The rainy season is just beginning in the Sahel. Can farmers and families actually go out and plant? And if they can't, then what? Like, what kind of crisis are you preparing for at the end of the summer?
The end of the summer could be absolutely catastrophic if the farmers can't get the seeds they need, the fertilizers they need, into the fields they need to get. So if that's compounded because of COVID, and if they can't get into the fields in this harvest time this fall, you could have bad on top of bad on top of bad. It's just not good.
David Beasley is the executive director of the United Nations World Food Program. Thank you for being with us, David.
Thank you, Marco.
You're with The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When war crimes happen and victims can't get justice in their own country, there's another place they can go, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in The Hague. President Trump made it clear this week what he thinks of the International Tribunal. The president issued an executive order yesterday that places visa restrictions and economic sanctions on members of the ICC and their families. The World's Roopa Shenoy explains why.
What this is really about is the International Court's investigation into alleged atrocities by U.S. military members in Afghanistan. In March, judges at the ICC gave prosecutors the go-ahead to look into possible torture and other war crimes. Catherine Gallagher represents two individuals who remain detained at Guantanamo without charge.
As U.S. investigations by the military, by the Congress, makes clear, United States citizens did commit serious violations of international law. But we've seen for the past two decades no investigations and no prosecutions of senior U.S. officials.
So she says it's appropriate for the ICC to be investigating. But the Trump administration has long opposed the investigation, and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the president has now taken steps that will hopefully stop it. The administration is also concerned about the possibility of the ICC investigating Israel's actions in Palestinian territories.
We cannot, we will not stand by as our people are threatened by a kangaroo court. And indeed, I have a message to many close allies around the world. Your people could be next.
Pompeo says the president is holding the ICC accountable for exceeding its mandate, engaging in a politically motivated investigation, and challenging U.S. sovereignty. Attorney General Bill Barr took it a step further, announcing an investigation by the Department of Justice into the ICC.
The U.S. government has reason to doubt the honesty of the ICC.
Barr says the DOJ has substantial, credible information of a long history of corruption and malfeasance at the ICC.
Worse yet, we are concerned that foreign powers like Russia are also manipulating the ICC in pursuit of their own agenda.
I mean, this is just absolutely preposterous.
That's Stephen Rapp, who was U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes during the Obama administration.
These are allegations with no proof whatsoever.
Rapp says that the Obama administration held off an ICC investigation into Afghanistan war crimes by showing the court that they were looking into it themselves. But now, by openly opposing the ICC, he says the Trump administration is undermining the global community's ability to bring war criminals to justice.
We're wounding ourselves, frankly, and making ourselves less of a leader when it comes to upholding human rights in the world.
Trump administration officials point out the U.S. isn't a member of the ICC, but the U.S. has worked regularly with the International Court to bring war criminals to justice, and the court has a mandate to prosecute crimes committed in any of the 123 countries that are a part of the ICC, including Afghanistan. Akhila Radhakrishnan is president of the Global Justice Center.
It boils down to the fundamental of you can't escape accountability when you go elsewhere and commit crimes.
But she says that's exactly what the U.S. is trying to do.
We need to cut through the veneer of what's really driving what this is, which is a fundamental, you know, position of the U.S. government that it should not be held accountable and its closest ally, Israel, shouldn't be held accountable.
The new U.S. sanctions on the ICC probably won't stop the court's investigation of war crimes in Afghanistan, says Nancy Combs, a human rights lawyer at the College of William and Mary Law School.
Once the United States comes out with guns blaring this way and tries to intimidate the court in the way that it has, one might expect a counterproductive response. The ICC prides itself on its independence. And so now, if it were to not bring prosecutions against the United States, it might look as though it's been intimidated.
The International Criminal Court has released a statement that says it stands by its staff and its commitment to justice. The president of the ICC's oversight body, Ogun Kwan, says he's convening a meeting next week for the group to consider how to renew its unwavering commitment to the court. For The World, I'm Roopa Shenoy.
Even during a pandemic, the Chinese military is becoming bolder. Its warplanes have been buzzing Taiwan. The Chinese Navy is also stepping up patrols of the strategic and oil-rich South China Sea. The U.S. Navy is responding. Two aircraft carrier battle groups are under orders to head for the Western Pacific. Sim Tak joins us from Brussels. He's with the strategic analysis group, Stratfor, a RAIN company. So, Sim, it's unusual for two aircraft carriers to be in one theater. What message is this deployment sending to Beijing?
Well, I think that the U.S. is sending a twofold message here. One is, of course, in response to the COVID-19 crisis, where, you know, China might have had some doubts about whether the U.S. was still there, given the brief loss of use of the Roosevelt carrier. But obviously, sending two carriers into the Pacific will remind China of the continued presence and commitment of the United States Navy. And in addition to that, of course, we have seen this happen against the background of heightened diplomatic and trade tensions between the United States and Beijing.
So it's muscle flexing by the U.S., is that it?
I think that's one way to categorize it. It is muscle flexing, but this muscle flexing has very real implications as well in terms of guaranteeing certain relationships with allies in the area and basically continuing to operate in freedom in certain waters where China has been trying to lock the U.S. out.
Yeah, China continues to provoke and kind of poke away in the South China Sea. I mean, given the risks and moves like this by the U.S., why do they continue?
Because they have a lot to gain, obviously, not only in terms of sovereignty, where, you know, they want to prove that China is that strong, great power that is able to project its own interests in this region. But there are also a lot of economical incentives in the South China Sea that China won't simply give up.
You said this is muscle flexing. That's kind of political theater. But you also said it's a risky move. It could lead somewhere. So where could it lead? To war?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily draw that line all the way to war. But of course, with any kind of increased military activity comes a potential risk of escalation, unintended escalation, that is. If we see Chinese aircraft or Navy vessels operating close to the U.S. vessels, there's always a chance for miscalculations. We've been able to avoid most of this over the past several years when this activity has been ongoing. But of course, at tense times, with additional assets in the area, that chance only increases.
Some experts say that aircraft carriers are no match for the overwhelming firepower China can deploy in terms of land-based missiles and drones. Are aircraft carriers obsolete?
Well, the discussion about whether aircraft carriers are obsolete is much wider than this. But I think it's fair to say that this particular deployment of two or even three carrier groups is not going to be able to carry a broader conflict against China. If this were to come to a war, which is, of course, still unlikely, these aircraft carriers would not stand a chance on their own. Within a broader spectrum of operations, if such a conflict were to emerge, I think we should take into account that aircraft carriers will still play a significant role in that.
Sim Tak is a military analyst with Stratfor. He's been speaking with us from Brussels. Thank you very much for this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World. Just head to theworld.org/newsletters. You're with the world. Sweden took a hands-off approach to the coronavirus. No formal lockdowns. With a high death rate, the country is now paying the price. So are foreigners living in Sweden who question the government's approach.
I've got friends who have sent me hate messages. I would say I've lost nearly every one of my Swedish friends.
Sweden's risky experiment still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. From Minneapolis to London and points across the globe, anger over racism, inequality, police brutality, and injustice are driving more large protests this weekend. To understand how activists see what looks like a moment of global solidarity, we got in touch with two of them. Siana Bangura is an author and poet and an organizer in London. Miski Noor is an organizer and writer with Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis. They've both been organizing and pushing for change in policing in their cities for years. Hi, Siana. Hi, Miski.
Hi.
Hey there.
I would just like to know first, what have the past 2 to 3 weeks or so been like for both of you? Miski, what has it been like for you?
It's been, an incredibly painful time in Minneapolis, seeing our folks be attacked and being attacked ourselves by police and white supremacists, being overtaken by the National Guard, and having so many of our community spaces burnt. And what we're trying to do is really build a city without police terror. We want justice for George Floyd, and we know justice isn't enough, which is why we've been saying that now is the time to defund the police and invest in community. Right now, what I was doing before getting on with you is listening to the Minneapolis City Council vote to disband the police department, right? So it's been hard, and it's been incredibly transformational, and it's been such a powerful, powerful thing to witness.
Sianna Bangura, London has seen what's going on in the States, in Minneapolis. What have you been feeling the last 2 or 3 weeks?
Firstly, Miski, massive solidarity to you folks. So I just want to thank you for that. And in terms of how we are trying to express solidarity over here, this is a moment of reckoning. So in terms of how I've been feeling, for the past 2 weeks, I have been in a state of all sorts of emotions, quite frankly, which I think is fair to say for a lot of Black people, if not the wider global Black community, the diaspora. Whatever happens in the US often, if not always, has a knock-on effect on the rest of us. And I think, I have been banging on for the longest time. This is just a fact of history that let's never forget that the UK is the belly of the beast. It's the racist parent of the USA. And so in my country, people have a really big culture of deflection, of saying it's not so bad here, at least we're not as bad as the USA. And it's like, where do you think they learn everything from, right? And so we are now forcing people to take a really long, hard look in the mirror in this country. This particular time, if I may say, feels a little bit different. And I do strongly feel that we've never had this in the midst of a global pandemic, where in the UK, the Black communities here have been disproportionately affected by the consequences of the COVID outbreak, right? And then to see that on top of that, in the same way that our siblings in the USA are also disproportionately wildly affected by the COVID outbreak, they are also, the police still have time to also kill you on top of that. And that is clearly unbearable. One big thing we've been doing is we're saying, well, actually, this is the time to reckon with the fact that actually that this country also has a prison industrial complex, and this country also kills Black people. So we stand in solidarity, but want to use this moment to also say, actually, look in the mirror, the UK, your history is disgusting, and you're not innocent either.
Yeah, I think something that gets lost very easily is the globalness of Blackness, right?
Absolutely.
And I think that it's really important to even name just the history of what the police is in this country and what they are intended to do, right? So Black communities are living in persistent fear of being killed by state authorities, mm-hmm. like the police. And so what's happening in Minneapolis is not happening just all over the United States, but also all over the world.
We're speaking with author, poet, and organizer Sianna Bangura, who's in London, and with Miski Noor, also a writer and an organizer with Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis. So, Miski and Sianna, I don't know if this is the first time since the killing of George Floyd that each of you has had the chance to be speaking across borders with another activist in another country about what's happened since his death. But since you are both here now, what would you ask each other about where the movement goes next? Like, how do you each see your work benefiting the other? Sianna?
Oh, I love that question. These have been great. I'm just really enjoying hearing Miski talk because it just gives me... it just gives me a lot of hope. Like I said, we are looking towards the USA, but also we're looking within ourselves and within our context, because it's really important to understand there are so many similarities, but it's not the same. And sometimes, in fact, often we get stuck on trying to do the exact same thing that's happening in the USA here, and it doesn't work because of the histories. But I guess a question I'm actually really interested in, Miski, is how are you making sure, I suppose, that you're bringing the community along with you at every step of the way, and maintaining that trust and clear communication. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah.
No, I appreciate that question, right? Because it's a moment of transformation, right? We are not the same organization that we were 2.5 weeks ago. And so it's about looking outside of ourselves, because it's very easy for this moment for us to all of a sudden feel accountable to everybody and then let everybody down, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think, Yeah, so I think it's about trying to not aim for perfection, but aim for integrity.
Miski, as you talk about community kind of based focus in activism, I want to come back to something you both brought up a few minutes ago. There's a recent history in the 60s and 70s of black activists in the U.S. connecting globally with Pan-African movements, for example. Do either of you see that the full power of this movement right now is international, or is the center of gravity of organized activism right now at a much more local level, dealing with local problems?
Sam, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think that's actually really, again, a really good question. And do you know what? My instinct immediately is like, of course, this is international. And I think that's the bottom line, that we have to be internationalists with our vision. But I think it's not an either or. And I think I'm trying really hard to make sure we don't fall into binaries. On the one hand, we need to be thinking internationally, learning from what our siblings all over the globe are doing. Because remember, actually, we're talking, you know, specifically about the US and the UK. But we know that the impact of George Floyd's death has had ramifications across the globe, right? We've seen lots of stuff going on. But that said, also, it's really important now more than ever to be looking locally.
Miski, your thoughts?
Yeah. I'm like, you know, queer theory, both and, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, we need all of it. I mean, we see ourselves responsible to a larger ecosystem of black organizing, right? The fight's going to look different on the ground, and our work is more powerful when we're actually connected to each other. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that anti-blackness is global, right? And so it's definitely both and. This is local and global.
There's so much more to discuss here. I'm going to keep on discussing it, but I just want to finally ask you both. I mean, personally, how hard is this? Like, how do you move forward? How do you find the energy to keep it sustainable? What's your advice?
Oh, gosh, this is this is really hard because it's been so right. emotional. The first few days, weeks, I just felt the global grief, and it was super duper heavy, like on a personal level, and actually made it very difficult for me to be able to move forward. That said, though, I feel like I've been like held by the people that I'm organizing with and the wider community, and what I can see, although change is slow, but because I think this feels a little different to what we've had before, it gives me hope. And I would like to say that, you know, although tearing down statues does not a revolution make, right? But some of the things I've been seeing in the UK as just like, even, you know, some symbolic actions kind of lifted my mood. Like, I want to see more of that stuff, but also remember that is just symbolism. But it's the kind of thing I noticed a lift in my mood the minute I saw that. I like seeing the people be like, okay, we're doing our thing and we're actually going to be empowered. But I also understand this is like a lifelong mission, quite frankly, and I've signed up for the lifelong mission. So I think I understand that it comes with the peaks and troughs. So it's making sure that we all are clear that we're in this for the long run. I think that actually is a healthy way to move forward.
Miski, where do you find the energy?
Deanna's answer is so hopeful. I'm like, do we have a choice? You know, I mean, it's incredibly painful to feel the individual grief and loss as a black person, knowing that this is how this system works and is intended to work. And then on top of that, trying to be organizing for the conditions in which this doesn't happen. And so what's really been fortifying me is I think, you know, I've learned a lot of lessons over the last 5 years. I have some real lessons about what it means to take care of our nervous systems. What does it mean to not internalize that? What does it mean to allow myself to cry when I need to and process grief and feeling to try to be inside of connection, to meditate. And I think like community has really showed up, right, in helping me to actually be able to take care of myself. I think that like joy and that the power and the winning and the engagement of my community and the excitement has given me a lot of life. And so I think all of the change, you know, Octavia Butler says God is change. All of that has been also really fortifying.
Miski Noor in Minneapolis with Black Visions Collective. Siana Bangura, poet, writer, filmmaker in London. Thank you both very much for your time and for this discussion. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And thanks. Solidarity to you. It's been such an honor to speak to you, Miski.
So good to speak to you. I hope you get to talk again soon. I appreciate y'all.
The death of George Floyd has led not just to protests and debates across the globe. People are sharing their stories of racism, police brutality, and social injustice. Those conversations are happening in some immigrant communities here in the States. Today, we want to introduce you to one man who's having some tough conversations about race and racism in his own family.
I experience racism almost all the time. It comes at me at all sides. whether it's a society standpoint or even a family standpoint. My name's Tehran Von Gosri. I'm a comedian. My father is Iranian and my mother is African American. While many Iranians are very good people, some of them can be very racist. It also happened with my Black family, where my Black family was prejudiced against my Middle Eastern side, especially after 9/11. There was this sense of danger and fear and paranoia that I had never felt before. I remember specifically one time a cousin of mine on my Black side asking me to tell him when the next 9/11 was going to happen, as if I had inside information and we all got these emails that warned us, because to him, we were all the same. I also have Iranian people, because I'm very active in the Iranian community as well. I have Iranian people who have called me, text me, even especially recently, telling me to tell my people not to loot their store. See how far that goes? All types of people are here. This isn't just one type of people. I've been speaking out. I believe everyone's been speaking out much more since the tragic murder of George Floyd.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
I always talk to everybody who is open to having a conversation with me, because I'm a true believer in educate, not humiliate.
دوستان عزیز، سلام عرض می‌کنم و درود فراوان بر شما.
I will have a conversation. I will take the time. I will express it as diligently as possible. There's always a lot of resistance. A lot of people have hardline opinions that they believe are truths. And then I slowly start breaking down their arguments. And one of the main ways that I do this is by asking them if they've actually ever read a single book on Black struggle, the history of racism in America, or African American history, for example. And the answer most times is no. A lot of immigrants are extremely proud of how they were able to come to this country with very little to nothing and make a lot for themselves happen. And I respect and admire that quality. The first thing I tell them is that we should never compare struggles. Comparison is the thief of compassion. Secondly, I express that while they came from countries and systems that were more oppressive in nature, they were able to escape and come here. Unfortunately, there is nowhere for us, Black people of color, to go. I never, ever argue against the United States of America. The United States of America is the best country. However, it fails very often. We all feel this for a reason. So maybe it would be prudent to simply listen, not give advice, not tell us how we should feel, not tell us what we should feel, not tell us what we should do, but at least be aware, at least have compassion. That's the minimal, the least that you can do. This is a symbol of fighting for justice and equality, not just in the United States, but for everywhere in the world. And I hope that a lot of communities use these protests in the right way and dedicate them to their causes as well.
That was Tehran Von Gosri. He's an Iranian-American comedian based in California. He shared his story with the world's Shirin Jafari. Sweden's light-handed approach to the coronavirus pandemic is causing problems with its neighbors. Finland is lifting travel restrictions for nearby countries, but not Sweden. Norway and Denmark are also giving the Swedes the cold shoulder. The Swedish government is not happy about this, but the numbers don't lie. The per capita death rate in Sweden from COVID-19 is far higher than in many European countries. For some foreign residents in Sweden, it's making them think twice about living there. Here's the world's Orla Barry.
Ava Panarese was born in Tuscany, in Italy, but for a long time she wondered about relocating somewhere far to the north.
My mom is Swedish, and I always had a dream of going to Sweden. I always heard such great stories for working moms like me, and especially for raising family and having two children. I thought, oh, let's try. Why not?
2 years ago, Panarese made that dream happen. She moved with her family to Lund in southern Sweden.
Where we live is a beautiful natural area. We have the beach 5 minutes away, a lake just across the road. So it's really a paradise.
But in late February, everything changed. After Panarese returned from a trip to Italy, her husband and her son got sick. She worried they might have contracted the coronavirus. Her son got better pretty quickly, but her husband, who suffers with respiratory disease, ended up in the hospital, and Panarese was alarmed at what she saw there.
Nobody in the hospital would wear a mask. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to help us. And they did not want to do the test, nor on me, because I was asymptomatic. I can understand that. But not even to my husband.
As countries across Europe went into lockdown in response to the coronavirus, Sweden took a far more relaxed approach. The government told its citizens to maintain social distancing, to stay home if they were sick, and it banned gatherings of more than 50 people. But for shops, bars, gyms and schools, it was business as usual. And Panarese says her two children were terrified.
They were feeling a little bit, oh my gosh, if I go to school and then I come back, I can kill my father.
Panarese is far from the only foreign resident in Sweden who's been alarmed by the country's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Irishman Keith Begg moved to Stockholm for love 7 years ago. In March, as the Irish government imposed a strict lockdown, Begg was horrified by the Swedish response.
Just the hedonism, packed bars, packed restaurants, cafes, and the attitude here was just simply, we might as well go out because we're going to get it anyway.
Begg says Sweden's strategy is driven by economics, and the high level of trust in government means Swedes were slow to question the country's approach, he says. But Begg is questioning it. He set up a focus group of medical experts, teachers and human rights activists to publicly push back against the government strategy. And that move is costing him dearly.
I've got friends who have sent me hate messages. I have colleagues who have blocked me from Facebook. I would say I've lost nearly every one of my Swedish friends.
Begg and his husband have been socially isolating since March. Alison Plumberg, originally from Minneapolis, also tries to keep to herself. She moved to Sweden 2 years ago with her husband and their two small children. When they go to the supermarket, she says, people stare.
We wear face masks that I made myself because they're really hard to find over here. And I try to ignore other people looking at me just because it is uncomfortable to be literally the only person in the grocery store nearly every time I've gone wearing that.
Plumberg loves the family-friendly side of Sweden, but she says the pandemic has exposed some deep flaws in the way things work.
I am really upset about the mandatory in-schooling laws that children between the ages of 6 and 15 must attend school, even if there are at-risk people in their homes or even if the children themselves have at-risk conditions.
At first, public support for the Swedish government strategy was riding high at 80%. But polls now show that's fallen to under 50%. In a recent interview, Chief Epidemiologist Anders Tegnell conceded that too many people have died, particularly in the country's long-term care homes. But Scottish native Anna Douglas says problems within the nursing home sector already existed long before the coronavirus.
There have been too many deaths, absolutely. And that is as a result of the way that we employ people who work in care homes. You know, that is a job that too many people are doing on 0 hours contracts. And therefore, you have people who are unwilling to be off sick if they are not feeling 100%. And therefore, they come to work and potentially can spread this disease.
Douglas says, on balance, the Swedish government seems to have got it right. She's happy to be in Sweden right now and not Scotland, and says the Swedish approach empowers people to think for themselves.
Mostly it's treating people as adults, so giving people the responsibility to take judgments and decisions themselves. but also putting the burden of responsibility onto people. It's something that we combined have to do together.
Laura Servant, who's originally from France, agrees. She says she's relieved to be living in Stockholm and not Paris, which saw one of the strictest lockdowns worldwide.
I was feeling very blessed and very lucky to have this freedom. If I want to go to the park, I can go to the park without fearing policemen arresting me and asking me why I'm here.
So what would she say to tourists wanting to visit Sweden right now?
Like, no, I don't think it's fair that they think they can come here and do tourism, because I won't be able to visit my family in a long time.
Alison Plumberg from Minneapolis will be seeing her family sooner than expected. She says she can no longer imagine raising her children in Sweden, so they're moving back to the US this summer. Irishman Keith Begg is also making plans to move back home. And as for the Italian, Ava Panarese.
It's the first time that I buy a house in my life, so I was thinking this is the country where I really want to stay and die. But I think thinking about the future, this is not the country where we will want to stay.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
I imagine some experts might agree with me. Sweden should probably lend an ear to the new release from Spanish singer Rosalia and American rapper Travis Scott. Their new single that came out a couple of weeks ago is a social distancing message. No new friends, don't play with people you don't know. Sad advice, perhaps, but hey, it's for your safety.
Ella tiene medida brazuca, esa mami es una chica.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. When you're not hearing us, stop by theworld.org to read us and see us. We're also on Twitter, @TheWorld. Stay safe, stay strong, and be healthy. We'll see you back here on Monday. Don't say a word of what you heard from when I came around. You get it fresh, you get this work right when you come in town. Need you right here. Know you the queen of giving ideas.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.